Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Recording on Thursday, August 5th, 2021. And no one cares. Everyone has their own experience with this. But our tech journey in the last 15 minutes to try to figure out how to record this show has been really shocking. Surprisingly difficult.
We're a little frazzled, as one of our coworkers, Clint, would say. Like, this is modern telephony? We've tried Slack. We've tried Skype. We've tried different headphones. We've tried different Wi-Fi networks.
Yeah. So we're doing it here, and that was content. That's 45 seconds of our lives that no one can get back, and us complaining about it. But we're here.
You're welcome.
Talking about things. I'm Jeff O'Neill. She's Rebecca Shinsky. Coming to you from BookRiot.com. Interesting-ish week. I've got off-the-menu items. Do you want to do that?
Or
I'm worried they might take the whole time.
That's
You know, so while we're in the showing you how the sausage is being made mode, what generally happens is that Rebecca is in charge of dropping most of the links into the agenda. She sort of has a passive filter throughout the week, what seems interesting. I typically go look at it a few hours before we record, and if there's anything I've seen or I think is missing, I'll add it in there. And sometimes we're real excited about the link. Sometimes we're not. Sometimes I don't realize until I'm looking at feedback and I can't really drop a link in there. I've got some other topic I don't, because I like to hit her like all good pro wrestlers from behind and with the back of a chair.
Yeah, you love a good like Publisher's Weekly list that you can make me guess
about. I really do. It's really my favorite thing. So I've got a little bit of that. But do you want to start with those? Are there any links you want to make sure we hit?
You know what? Let's start with those, because things have gone sideways, and at least we can control this.
There you go. We can control the things you're not ready for. That's a bad place to be.
I'm
in. But first,
this is the state we're in right now. Is
there you go.
Opt
That's
into
right.
this moment.
You're choosing for your mic not to work. All right, we're going to do a sponsor break, and we'll come back in just a second.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social-climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must-read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric, and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
I think the big news in the world of books and reading was not a world of books and reading news only thing this week. I'm not sure if you saw this. And again, the only real news is that the date has been confirmed for the release of Amazon's Lord of the Rings series, ooh, September 22nd, 2022. Okay. So we're a little more than a year away. Principal photography is wrapped, and now it's just all computering in, you know, the leaves of Rivendell or whatever, which, and making it look like a different place.
I imagine is a not small percentage of that production. There's a lot of leaves in Rivendell.
There's a lot of leaves in Rivendell, short time. We know that they have spent $1 billion on
a
this. Like, it was either this or beat Richard Branson to space for right. Bezos and Amazon. They're like, you know, we'll take a few weeks on the rocket, the dildo rocket, and then we'll just make sure we get the thing out. I mean, I can't look at, I mean, we all know, like, did we they know? They're like, this is the best we can do. And they're like, yeah, let's green light that. I think we're done here. I don't never will understand that. Anyway, it's fine. It's nothing to be ashamed of. You can use it in your next school board hearing to protest the book.
Just drop it on the table and kneel.
Yeah, just drop it on the table. And that struck me because that's now in the can. It's coming. We have a date. This fall, we have Dune, which I don't know if anyone's been watching the Olympics out there, but they really put some money behind that, and there's a really beautiful trailer. It looks like it costs $2 billion. And then Foundation from Apple is also coming out in October. I think October 15th or 21st or something like that. So now, these are the three pillars of 20th century science fiction and fantasy. Mm-hmm. It that started as books. Star Wars is to the side, and then you take Marvel stuff. But when it comes to books as we know them, these are the three. They're all coming out. And I think it's just worth noting that.
Are these bigger than Game of Thrones? And what is it? Wheel of Time hasn't been adapted, has it?
It's coming out. There was a cover reveal for the TV tie-in edition. It's going to star Rosamund Pike, I think, in the lead role.
Interesting.
That's coming out. I don't know exactly when. I think they are bigger. I think in terms of things that haven't been adapted, well, I guess Lord of the Rings was adapted. But these are the three big bullets, like the giant franchises with trillion-dollar corporate, I mean, I'm not joking.
Yeah.
Trillion-dollar corporations staking the future of major pieces of their business on it. What a great time to be a CGI house, I would guess.
No kidding.
My brother Kyle, who some of you heard or knew us talking about with Annotated, help us edit, works in post-production and sound. And I haven't talked about this in a while, but it was really over the last year, like every audio engineer in the world is basically booked. If you're looking for a job, like, try to learn how to do that. Be a nurse first, because we need nurses and you're always going to need nurses, but audio engineers as well. And it just struck me as like, there's nothing waiting in the wings, which is, we haven't been at a place with this since my childhood of, are they ever going to make a movie of Wrinkle of Time, Chronicles of Narnia, The Hobbit, X-Men? They're all kind of done. This is kind of, we're out. And here's the other thing, and this is where I was trying to get to. We've got nothing waiting in the wings. We've got there is no next book of the Hunger Games thing we're waiting for. There is no next Harry. There is no whatever. It's kind of all taken up. Now, we've got adaptations coming of N.K. Jemisin and Octavia Butler, and I'm looking forward to those things. But in terms of mainstream cultural zeitgeist, we're kind of tapped out. Am I wrong? Am I missing something?
No. Or if you are, I don't know enough about 20th century sci-fi to know what it is.
Yeah, right.
But those are the biggies, and Dune is those that like ones. The really big one that's just been sort of lingering forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is weird that in this moment where the hottest thing you can have is a franchise, IP, ready to be adapted, in the world of books over the last 15 years has provided a lot. It's provided Harry, it's provided Hunger Games, it provided Handmaid's Tale, Walking Dead. If you extend it out to books and or comics and graphic novels, whole, you know, multiple universes there, but like we've kind of strip mined the ravine, and it's just like a big empty hole now.
Yeah,
we got to make do.
I think that's true, and that it's just going now, it's just part of the production of books and TV, that like, can this new thing be an adaptation? Because we have mined most of the established properties and established right. like series or franchises have landed somewhere in this, like it's been done or it is being done or for some actual reason it won't be done. Yeah. Like, you know, the Secret History won't be adapted for reasons of Donna Tartt. There was a great piece in The Atlantic this week that's on the agenda, but we might not get to it because of whatever your surprise items are for your WWE moment, that talks about how TV adaptations are changing literary publishing. And one of the notes there is that Rotten Tomatoes cites that there are currently 125 literary adaptations in development at the moment. And they even did some like meta-analysis of what properties, kind of features in a book make it more likely to be adapted and how that's factoring into not just the decisions about adaptation, but even like books getting acquired specifically because they will be ripe for adaptation. So we'll drop that in and y'all can check that out. That's from The Atlantic by Alexander Manshall, Laura McGrath, and J.D. Porter.
Yeah, and, you know, I think also, I mean, everyone at HBO and George Martin, I mean, bless his heart. I don't say that condescending, like, bless his heart, in an unprecedented situation. But no one should be waiting on that book. I think culturally we are no longer waiting on that book. Like, maybe it comes at some point, we don't. I don't think we're waiting on the Rothfuss book. That's not coming out either. Those are, I think, the other two big ones. But, like, I just don't know where you go from here. And in this moment, it is interesting how, and again, there's things like, okay, we've got Shadow and Bone. It's relatively recent, but it hasn't captured, I don't think yet, maybe it will. It hasn't captured the zeitgeist. It hasn't captured attention in a way that some of these other things do. There's The Court of Thorn and Roses, which is apparently a pretty big series. Sarah J. Maas, I think Bloomsbury publishes that, which I know a lot of people like. And this is not disparaging them, but that is a lot of rope on the gym rope to slide down. From Lord of the Rings to Court of Thorn and Roses.
Well, it feels very similar to when we look at bestseller lists sometimes, and it's like the number one or number two thing has sold a floppity jillion copies, and then you go down to like just kind of a jillion for the next ones, and there's that big step. Like, there's just a huge space between the top tier, like ripest fruits for adaptation, and everything else that can get adapted. Like, if you have some kind of audience, you can get an adaptation these days, but it still takes a lot. We don't have a monoculture anymore, but it still takes a lot to break into that top level where, like, you could be water cooler conversation if people still did water cooler conversation.
So to extend, I mean, we've said, I've called a top on the Gold Rush adaptations for what I'd say 5 years now, Rebecca. Yeah. I've called three out of the last one recessions, as they say. They make fun of economics for doing this stuff. But at some point, there isn't any gold. Like, okay, maybe to extend the metaphor painfully, there's more gold in the hills than I thought. But gold takes longer to make naturally than it takes to mine it. And I think the Lord of the Rings, the Wheel of Time, you know, throw those in there, the Dunes. Those were undervalued. Yes. They were just sitting in their hills getting bigger, and no one could do it. No one could mine them successfully.
Generations of people who had read those books and were like wishing, hoping, waiting for an adaptation of some kind someday. And it's kind of like, you know, they say that like every writer's first book is the book they've been spending their whole life writing, or like a musician's first album is one they've been spending their whole life writing. And it's the second one that takes, like, you have to like go deep and find new content and like produce some new ideas that you haven't been noodling on for the entirety of your life up till that moment. I feel like that's what's happening in this world of adaptations, that like in the first, I don't know, 5 or 10 years of it, we got all or most of the things that like people who wanted to adapt big properties found them and adapted those big properties that had just been sitting there waiting. And it's meaningful that they had generations of fans to make it into a big thing. And now we're in the land of, you can write a great new book. You can write A Visit to the Goon Squad, which I think is in development for adaptation. You can get a solid readership who will enjoy your thing, but the audience for it is just going to be limited because we haven't been waiting for this our whole lives. It hasn't been a generation of fans that it was also big enough, and it's meaningful that these things are like Dune, Lord of the Rings, Foundation, like they're old enough also that, you know, people had to wait, and they came out at the time when monoculture was more of a thing, and like everybody read Lord of, like, you know, as my dad would tell it, of being in college in the 60s, like everybody read Lord of the Rings, and I inherited his copy of The Hobbit, you know, that we don't have those anymore. There are not books right now that everybody who's like 19 is reading. And in 30 years, those people are all going to be waiting for the adaptation of that. Also, it probably won't take 30 years for that thing to get adapted.
No, they get optioned before they hit the they hit the thing. You know the Scott Rudin. There was one, we saw this. Scott Rudin or other producers will go scout the thing before it happens. And I do wonder, are we in the last 4%, say, of latent interest in properties that haven't been adapted yet? Mm-hmm. Like, what basically is happening is you take, again, you adapt things for a lot of different reasons. One is, a book is a great minimum viable product. Someone makes a story, they create characters, and you can sort of pick them up and do a lot of the storytelling work for a movie. Movie making is hard enough, I was saying, without having to make the story and get all the character beats and all that kind of stuff. So there is use in just adapting a book, even if no one cares about the book itself. Like, it's a ready-made package. I think we're past the point where you're going to say, boy, everyone loved that book, and that's going to make a meaningful difference in the performance of the adaptation that comes after it. I can't think of one where... I really can't think of one where that was a... That's really a thing. I mean, like, the test will be Where the Crawdads Sing, I guess. Mm-hmm. As much as we love that book, no one... There hasn't been a recent book that more people have read than that. And are we like, that book is going to be more successful than it would have been because of the people that read it? I just don't feel that way. I just don't feel that people are going to rush out and go see it. Now, I'm biased against it because I've read the book, as to quote Virginia Woolf. Dorothy Parker, pardon me.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think that's an interesting test because 50 Shades of Grey, I think, was more widely read, but it was also like such a cultural phenomenon that people went to see the movie who just wanted to know like what was going to be happening there, what it was about.
Yeah.
You know, I did it like as a field trip with girlfriends of like, I've read these books, like let's pour some Jack Daniels into our Coke and see what's going to happen for the next 2 hours. And I don't think that's going to happen with Crawdads. So it's not the same kind of cultural phenomenon. It's like a contained book phenomenon. There aren't just like people sitting in the world who have heard about the Crawdads book and want to know what it's about and be conversant in it, but aren't going to read it. It's not sparking some bigger conversation the way that 50 Shades of Grey did around sexuality and BDSM. Like, I don't even know what bigger conversation Crawdads could spark. wow, which is a statement.
Wow.
Wow. That came out a little harsher than it sounded in my head.
Sometimes off the cuff is straight from the heart.
It's what we do here.
Yeah,
I think that, I mean, based on how many people read the Crawdads book, the movie will get some viewers, but it's not, nobody's like, you know, counting the days, I don't think, until that adaptation, the way that people have been waiting for literal decades to see the Foundation trilogy or Dune.
So this is all entrance music, me coming off the stage with fireworks and smoke shows, and, you know, I've got my spandex on.
Okay.
this is all me ready. I've got the chair now. So the chair is, what is the highest profile ongoing book series right now?
Oh.
And I took Martin and Rothfuss off the table, if you'll agree with me. I'm willing to reconsider that. But I think for this, take them off the table, because... There's a real chance we're never going to get either of those books again. Real chance.
Sadly, I agree with you. Oh my God, I don't know. I'm inclined to say it must be some YA thing.
Is The Court of Thorns and Roses going still? Is that still going?
I don't know. I know people love
Terrible
Sarah
sign
J.
that we don't know. Let's say that. Yeah. Terrible sign that you and I don't know.
I love Sarah.
For everything.
I know that people love Sarah J. Maas. I've not read her. I don't know if that series is still going.
Very tough. I mean, look, I hit myself with the chair first because I tried to do this.
I'm glad that you don't have an answer at the
No, room. I don't have an ace up my sleeve. I really don't. I don't have the next move I made is like, okay, so it doesn't have to, what if it's not a series, but what if it's like, you know, like our boy Langdon. So it's not a series exactly, but it's a IP, right? The Langdon IP. Well, Lost Symbol going straight to Peacock, which I guess is where you put some of this stuff, but no one cares about that.
No one cares about that. Is there I don't think there's like a Nora Roberts situation that's getting adapted. There's not, weirdly, there's not a James Patterson TV, there's not an Alex Cross TV show, is there?
No, they took their shot with Tom Cruise, I think,
and
as
they
Jack,
did.
Or no, Alex Cross was someone else. I get them confused, and Jack Bridger, Alex Cross.
Right, they did a couple adaptations, they did movies, like, in the 90s, I think, like, ooh, I want to say, is Kiss the Girls a James Patterson?
It is, that's right, because that was Denzel and Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, but there are...
Or no, that was a Bone Collector. They all get their own together because they're kind of the same
setup. Kiss the Girls was a movie, and it's based on a James Patterson book, and that's a 90s joint. It seems to me like enough people read, certainly enough people buy those Alex Cross books that you could make a case for developing the Alex Cross series for TV. I'm kind of surprised that there's not one on like Amazon somewhere.
Yeah, I mean... The Jack Ryan series with Krasinski was fairly popular. I watched those, and
watched
they were
those.
What they were. You know, Michael B. Jordan is trying to make the Without Remorse Jack Clark, I think is the character's name, Rainbow Six. But again, I don't think it's going to be successful. And they're so interchangeable, right? Okay, it's another military fetishistic thriller about a guy who has been... jilted somehow and is kind of working alone but also not with the tacit approval of the powers that be. Like, we've seen that a million times before. There's not a big comic book property even. I mean, it, like, what's sitting out there? Like, we now have like three versions of the Joker. We're in the multiverse with Marvel. The most exciting thing to happen in the Marvel series was either the introduction of the Fantastic Four or X-Men, which we've already had movies made out of
and
them before.
I think book-wise... I mean, it's not nearly as high profile as it should be, but N.K. Jemisin, I'm trying to remember if we've heard that those are being adapted.
They are, but I'm not sure if it's The Broken Earth or The Inheritance. I've lost track of which of the multiple trilogies. Again, those have a chance to be really interesting, great series, but again, it's pretty far down the rope. Mm-hmm. It really is. Ursula K. Le Guin, I was thinking about. Wizards of Earthsea might be interesting. There, I think there has been a series that wasn't awesome about that, but also Wizards of Earthsea, what's the Q rating on that? It's pretty tough, I think, on the whole. So, I don't know. It's, and I'm not saying this is bad or wrong or anything. I think these are hard. These are hard things to do. And even the streaming services trillion-dollar companies have a hard time making a thing a thing.
Yeah, well,
like, this is a thing a thing. It's really, really tough to do. It's just maybe the hardest thing in culture to do is to make a new franchise or IP that people care about en masse.
They did the smart thing by starting with the lowest hanging fruit that had the longest running desire from audiences to be a thing. So we've gotten most of these at this point.
And interestingly, the Lord of the Rings thing, like, it's actually a spinoff, essentially, right? I mean, Tolkien, getting my J's mixed up, he was, like, writing his own fan fiction for, like, 60 years. So, like, there's plenty of, like, ephemera to run around with. But even, like, you look what Stephanie Meyer is doing. Mm-hmm. You look what E.L. James is doing. They're, like, they're doing spinoffs, alternate point of view, like, they're going back to the well. Suzanne Collins went back to the well.
Yep.
Margaret Atwood went back to the well. They all go back to the well. It does over time. I'm not a Stephen King reader. I don't like horror, and so I'm kind of was out from the beginning. And some of the stuff he's written isn't horror, but it does remind me again what a wonder his career is, because he doesn't write a 6-book series. That's not how he made
his
bones. Like, he's written like 50 billion books, and like 15 of them have a Q rating above 50%, I would say. We're more than... It's just remarkable
that's
stuff.
That's maybe the most surprising thing to me is that, like, HBO hasn't snapped up, you know, a 10-adaptation deal with Stephen King for a bunch of the things that weren't already made into movies. Like, we watched... I'm touch and go on Stephen King. It really depends on, like, what the story
Definitely,
is going to
yes.
be. And we watched The Outsider last year, and it was creepy and good and well done and beautifully cast, and I thought they did a really wonderful job with it. And in the moment, Bob and I were having that same kind of conversation of, like, what else is there by Stephen King? Like, he's so prolific. There has to be plenty stuff by Stephen King that even the, like, less popular Stephen King works are still very popular by regular book standards.
Yeah.
For
I mean, they've tried The Stand, right? Yeah. Which was a failure. There was another one, The Dark Tower. And I haven't read these series. And those are, When I say he doesn't have a series, I don't mean he doesn't have any series, but he is not known for a series, right? He's not like synonymous with a series, right. Which is really pretty remarkable. So I don't know. I mean, maybe this era of relying upon the latent interest culture has in properties that haven't been recently adapted has come to an end, because it's very difficult to do. I'm surprised that anything in sort of the seed stages hasn't really caught on. It hasn't. Shadow and Bone is about the closest thing I can think of.
Well, and The Witcher.
After that, it's tough.
Was it a weird case? I think The Witcher was an edge case because the show got bigger than the books, and then it boosted the sales there.
You know, Ernie Klein tried to do, you know, Ready Player One was a, that was one where it was a book phenomenon and there was a lot of juice around the movie because of the book. Mm-hmm. The movie was passable. He writes Armada, which wasn't great. Ready Player Two came out. I never read it because the people I know who did are like, eh.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of fizzled out. Yeah. It just kind of, that's, this happens more often than not.
I need Andy Weir to write a series that can go to Netflix.
I actually had that note for you. It's like, are we sure that the main character of Project Hail Mary shouldn't have been Mark Watney and it's a Damon franchise? Are we sure that wasn't the move
in some
way? Can we just
like retcon ourselves and forget that we know Matt Damon was Mark Watney and he can star in all the Andy Weir movies? Like,
rewrite the screenplay for Project Hail Mary so it is Mark Watney or something? Yeah. Like, because that would have, that was mine. It's like the Andy Weir vibe is bankable, I think.
It is,
it's going to be
bankable. And I think we've talked about it. Like, I think Project Hail Mary is great. It's going to be a really fun and interesting adaptation to see. And when we were talking, when Bob and I were talking about it the other night, we were kind of, there's like two time frames that the book moves back and forth between the present and then how the hero ended up in that present by flashing back. And we were trying to figure out what we think the construction of the movie is going to be.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is actually what I want. I want this book to be a TV show, because then you could do a really full, like, fleshed out, here is where they are, and sort of like then you step back for a whole episode and then you come forward for a whole episode, or like a sort of half and half thing like Lost used to do, where you'd have flashbacks built into everything. And I just feel like we're gonna lose, there's so much richness in that story that will be lost by condensing it all into, you know, 2.5 hours that and I would be down for, like, let's have Andy Weir write a series that we can all get excited about, and then let's wait for that to be adapted.
I mean, it's a sign of how hard up we are for ready-made franchises in the world of books and reading that The Rock and Emily Blunt are starring in a show, in a movie based on a third-tier Disneyland ride in the form of Jungle Cruise.
Wait, and apparently they're both very good in it.
I will watch The Rock and Emily Blunt swashbuckle their way through Target. Like, I don't care.
Truly.
I mean, so maybe it doesn't matter, and maybe I don't really understand, again, Disney operates in three-dimensional chess in a way I don't understand. Does that make me, is that supposed to make me want to go to Disneyland more so I can see the ride that is a, that is totally not at all like the movie I just saw, which it can't be?
Yeah,
or am I supposed to like the movie more because I've heard or been to, I'm not sure what the synergy there is.
Or is it
don't
as simple as like, we're out of things to adapt, so let's go to the rides and see what stories we can make up? Like,
I guess so. I mean, it's a good title. You know, it's on the tin. It's a Jungle Cruise. I'm in. There's, you know, jungles and cruises.
Great.
Both terrifying.
Your favorite
turns
things.
Out. Yeah, but I like both of those things. I can be motion sick and get bit by snakes. Wonderful. Sounds great. One of the virtues of a boat is not snakes, except on a Jungle Cruise.
Family Feud category of like the five places you're least likely to find Jeff O'Neill.
Yeah,
two of them are
right.
The jungle and cruises.
It's a really tough look for me. So that was the one real... I'd love to hear podcast@bookriot.com.
Like, what are we missing?
If we missed something, or if you had to draft like the top three, let's say you had, and maybe we can think about this for a future segment. Let's say you had three chips, and with those chips, you could acquire any non-adapted book property. And for the purposes of this, we'll assume that there might, you know, we can't know if they're all options somewhere, but we don't know they're an active development. We just don't know that. What do you pick?
Yeah, tell us.
I'm having a very, very hard time.
Me too. What else is
Let's
in your...
Let's do a sponsor break. Right. I got one more. Sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Where Sleeping Girls Lie by Farida Ibike Iyamide. And if you recognize the author's name, then you know that she writes Fire, YA, Dark Academia. The last one she wrote, which was TheBomb.com, was Ace of Spades. It was a New York Times bestselling book. So in this new one, a girl new to boarding school discovers dark secrets and cover-ups after her roommate disappears. So the girl, the new girl, is Sade. She goes to this prestigious new boarding school, and on her first night, her roommate Elizabeth disappears and people think that she had something to do with it. So the more Sade investigates Elizabeth's disappearance, the more she realizes there's more to the school and the students that she realized. Secrets lurk around every corner and beneath every surface, secrets that rival even her own. Ooh, twists on twists. You already know what it is. Make sure to pick up the new book. And thanks again to Where Sleeping Girls Lie by Farida Ibike Iyamide for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? Six award-winning best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all six short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laurith Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all six short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
While I was doing my my list for our fall preview draft episode, we're going to use the same format again. This time we are each coming up with our own list. We're not drafting off a shared list, so we could come out of left field. My long list now has 87 books on it. Now, having said that, I fully when I actually come to the ones where I might actually select and to try to defeat Rebecca Shinsky in the field of battle, there's at least 30 of those that are just sort of for me, and you know, I just wanted to capture while I was doing it.
One of them is a history of spaghetti and meatballs.
Yeah, it's a short history, though, thankfully. I'll have to wait for the definitive history at some point. I lost my track. Okay, a couple of thoughts coming out of that list that I wanted to run by you. We can use kind of the old Letterman. One of my old favorite Letterman segments was, is this something or nothing, mm-hmm. right? And so this is something or nothing for future, not full episode bit gig or gags for us, gimmicks for us, but maybe like a half a show kind of a gag.
Okay.
Here's a proposed gag. We read the Bill Clinton, James Patterson book and the Clinton Penny book. And talk about which one's better.
Okay.
Do we like that? What do you think of that segment? It does require us to read two books, but let's say we didn't worry about that. Do you like that as a segment? Is that interesting as a segment to you?
Maybe. I am predisposed to assume that Hillary and Louise Penny are going to be way better than James Patterson and Bill Clinton. But I'm willing to collect the data and find out.
Second question about that book. We talked about it before. How did this happen? Did Hillary look at Bill and was like, I want a piece of that?
Oh,
How did this go down?
Hillary.
You know, yes, please hit me with
Hillary
this.
Clinton and Louise Penny are friends. They've been friends.
I know
friends
you told me
while.
That, but like, and but did they not, this didn't occur to them before?
I mean, Hillary Clinton's been busy until the last couple of true. Years.
That's a fair point.
So Louise Penny was on an episode of Hillary's podcast in the last couple year or so, and they talked about how they've been friends for quite a long time and like write emails to each other about the books that they're reading and that Hillary Clinton loves Louise Penny's Inspector Gamache series. And they decided it would be fun to write a book together.
Okay. That's observation one. Observation two is, do we need to talk about the Franz Renaissance? We've DM'd about it ourselves.
Oh. I guess
I want to take the reader's pulse, but let's talk. Tell me about the Friends Innocence, because you independently DM'd me and then I responded. let's bring this out in the open. Let's get it out there.
Jonathan Franzen has a new book coming out. I think it's this. Is it this fall? I haven't looked at the
it
publish.
Is.
Okay, it's this
it
fall.
It is this fall.
And it sounds interesting.
Tell the people, because I think it does too.
Honestly, I don't remember what it's about at this point.
I'll hit you with it. I'll hit you with it then.
I just remember that it came across my desk of like, oh, there's a new Jonathan Franzen book. I was doing my knee-jerk eye roll response to Jonathan Franzen and then read the synopsis and was like, you know what? That sounds like it might be good. And in the like original day of Jonathan Franzen, like when the corrections was a new thing, I read the corrections and I liked it. I don't know if I would like it if I read it today, but I have I don't have exclusively negative experiences reading Jonathan Franzen. And I think that I'm coming around on some of the things we previously perceived as bad takes that he had about the internet.
Yes. So, he was right for the wrong reasons about some internet stuff,
I think
I'd say.
That's a good way to put it. And so I think I'm curious enough. I think the DM that we had was like, hey, I think I might read the new Jonathan Franzen. And I've been seeing folks like kind of show up in my Instagram feed also like having the galley and being excited about it. And it feels like it's significant on the two levels of one, that people are like excited about a new Jonathan Franzen and that we're like outing ourselves publicly about it now.
Well, that we're willing to keep our eyes and hearts and minds open to the possibility that there's
like
something here.
Acknowledging it. Because I think it's possible that it would have been like just a bunch of people secretly reading the new Jonathan Franzen. But folks are talking about it. And that was interesting to me. Because I think it was about a month or two ago when we were kind of privately like, you know what? I think I'm going to maybe read the new Franzen and see what that's all about. And I certainly like to know if the thing is good or not and not rely on the buzz. So I think that's what I think we're going to do it. So is this something or nothing? Should we do like a segment on an episode where we read it and talk about
it? Yes. Is that something we're interested in doing? Try to give a fair shake as possible to the Friends Innocence. Like, is this a real thing? Well, I guess the idea of the Friends Innocence even now I think is real. That was my first question to you, but I had stacked it because I think we agree with that.
Yeah.
And the second one is, do we want to mess with this particular title here?
I think
see what we see.
I think this is a thing. It's a something. Because assuming we both do read it, we're going to talk about it.
Right.
So we might as well.
Might as well put on tape.
Yep.
So I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but the hook is that it's a multi-volume, like it's a start of a series or a trilogy or something like that. So it's a multi-generational saga that starts with, we're going to ring some bells here. A preacher having a crisis of faith, both family and otherwise, I think, and it begins in 1971. So it's kind of like our parents' age, being middle age. You and I both love a multi-generational family saga.
Yep.
And we like preachers. There's all sorts of interesting stuff going on there. It's like Ordinary People meets Gilead. I'm all in on this kind of thing.
Yeah, I have such a weakness for crisis of faith. Usually it's crisis of faith memoirs, but I'm interested in what that looks like in fiction. There's potential here.
Good.
There's just
potential. I think. And, you know, I'm not going to be all in on the trilogy if I start the first one, but I want to give it a fair shake. I think the other thing that's happened, and I want to take your temperature on this too, and I'm really thinking through this publicly, so it's not all the way baked. The real first round of, like, enough already, Jonathan Franzen, happened in a different time online.
Mm-hmm.
A completely different time. In which the degrees of ass showing online, we did not know how low your pants could go. And we did not know the kind of stuff we were going to find out about people.
It's true.
And that Franzen was cranky about Twitter and was like, maybe conflicted about being an Oprah's book club pick is way different than the stuff we've learned about some of these dudes.
I think you're right that he was right for the wrong reasons. Like he had his hot takes about Twitter without really having experienced Twitter at a time when people who were on Twitter still loved it and were having a largely positive experience with it. And this is like 2010 to like 2014-ish was maybe like the golden time.
Yeah.
And then,
I feel like right around the time we started the site, because Twitter was the most important distribution awareness venue when we started Book Riot.
Yeah.
That's where we weren't doing blogs, we weren't doing email, we weren't even doing Facebook, really. That came a little bit later.
Right.
Or Instagram. And I think that's about right.
Yeah,
I think I agree
somewhere
with
in there. And then, you know, the run-up and then the 2016 election and everything that came after it have really changed Twitter. And I think just the evolution of online discourse has evolved into a level of ass showingness. Do we have to mark this episode explicit?
I don't think so. It could be a beast of burden we're talking about there. You know, you're parading your donkeys. Is that a euphemism for that?
Parading your donkeys.
Showing your ass.
Show title. How have we not had a segment that's like Today at the Donkey Parade?
The Donkey Parade. Yeah, we had Turkey of the Week, and it really became Donkey the Donkey Parade.
I mean, this is a good analogy for the internet. We used to have like a Turkey of the Year or a Turkey of the Week, and now it's just like a daily Donkey Parade. And so I think that the feeling on like Twitter now, or the feelings about Twitter now, really resonate with what like Jonathan Franzen had to say about it.
Yeah.
6 or 8 years ago, and he was at a weird space and time, and maybe wasn't speaking from experience about it. Mm-hmm. People do react negatively to that. Like, don't just preach from your ivory tower about this thing you don't understand. But it doesn't negate the ability to write a good book.
Nope.
That's what we do here.
So I think there's three factors going into the, well, actually I'd say four factors that have the makings. It's like weather forecasting. You can see some things on the horizon that could combine to have a friend's Renaissance. One, I think, is the things we dinged him for, just about his, you know, being out there online. We're in a different mode of like what gets a demerit and what doesn't, mm-hmm. in a different kind of way. Two is the things he was cracking on then that we're giving him demerits for. We kind of agree with him through the side of our mouth. Things have transpired. We're like, you know, you weren't wrong ultimately, even though I'm not sure you actually foreseen the things the way they went. I think another thing that's important to talk about now is that when Franzen was at his peak, the diversity of books and reading was much, much, much different than it is now.
True.
There's still ways to go. Mm-hmm. But he is just one of many, many now, where he was on the cover of Flippin' Time. I mean, it's hard to remember. And like, was the thing, and it was like, was the white hot center of middle brow to upper brow commercial crossover, whatever, competing directly with the Jennifer Weiners. I mean, famously, the back and forth in the Times and other places. I'm not sure if that war is over, but if it's being contested, it's for stakes no one cares about at this point. So that's another piece of it, is like, he's not, the centrality of him is less representative of the world of books and reading than it once was. Mm-hmm. And the fourth thing is he could write some books, as you said. Like, that's the other, what's the one with Patty? I can't remember. It's the one with the bird about the
Freedom
cover. Freedom, thank you. Pretty good. It had some flaws, but what doesn't? It's hard to write. Here's another thing I've appreciated for him now than more than ever, especially if we had the genrefication of literary fiction. It is so hard to write a relevant contemporary fiction literary novel right now. I think it's really hard to do because there's so much, hard to know what to grab onto. The world is much more interested in diversity of opinions. There's no center anywhere, so I think that's good. But in terms of like, who writes it's like Celeste Ng writes the most popular commercial fiction, or you've got to write a beach book, or it's like maybe has a time travel, or someone got murdered. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of hard to do. So I have an appreciation for how difficult it is to write a relevant contemporary novel about American life in a way that can break through.
Yeah,
it's just very difficult.
It is. And I think it's telling that the best work of literary fiction either of us has read this year or maybe in the last couple of years is one that is deeply about our relationship to technology, with Clara and the Sun. Like,
yes,
straight up, not genrefied work of literary fiction right now, with as entangled as our lives are with technology, is really, really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, there's been some that have been that have had a moment, like Such a Fun Age. You know, some of those things have had a moment. We thought some others might have more of a moment than they turned out to get, but like, it went from that being the only space of white guys talking about white guy problems to it's everything all the time and there's no center, which I think maybe gives, you know, you need a comeback story for these, to the McConaissance and other kind of azances. Like, now Brendan Fraser is having a renaissance, right, and being cast and stuff. I think it's interesting to see that the world needs to move on enough to give you a chance. And the stakes have to be lower about whether or not we give you a chance. The temperature has to come down a little bit to give you a chance. So I guess I hope all books are good, I guess. I don't know why I'm being sheepish about hoping. I hope all books are good. I hope this is one of them. So we'll have to see about that. Let's see. Any other bits that came out of this? Here's a concern of mine.
Okay.
Are we over food memoirs?
Oh.
There's the definitive oral biography.
Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumis, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is. And she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode.
Biography by Lori Wolliver, which is coming out. Which is that the apex, the zenith? Like, what do I want after that? I got the Chang, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about Crying in H Mart. And I'm like, where do I go next after Crying with H Mart and Eat a Peach? And then the end of the Bourdain. This is going to be the end. I mean, this is the one we want. This is the oral biography. Like, everyone sort of
so good.
Doing the wake. I know it's good. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to do it on audio for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't think they took my advice that I gave them way too late about having the actual people telling the stories as the audio, but that's neither here nor there. But after that, there's a couple of food memoirs that seem fine. There's the Stanley Tucci one you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You said Josh thought it was pretty good, but okay. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I wonder if pretty good, but not... I wonder if that's the best I'm looking for. Have we done the food memoir thing? Like, I don't know where the Undiscovered Country is there. Talk to me about my feelings there.
That's an interesting question. I think there's just such different kinds of food memoir. Like, I think that, like, Ruth Reichel and Tony Bourdain are doing very different things in what their food writing was doing, and that David Chang, it felt like Eat a Peach evolved that some. There's the, like, gritty chef in the restaurant food memoir, and then there's the here's what food means to me memoir, and Crying in H Mart I don't really think is a food memoir. It's a memoir about loss and cultural identity, and food is just part of cultural identity. And if it had been that, like, her connection to her mother, Michelle Zahner, if her connection to her mother was like that they went to TJ Maxx together, and or like some Korean equivalent of TJ Maxx, and it had been like Crying in TJ Maxx, it would have not been like a retail memoir. You know, it's like that book is just not really about the food is in it, but it's not about the food. And I think I am always here for a well-done, like, beautifully crafted exploration of these important elements of our lives, and food and eating is certainly one for me. But it's like I'm upping the ante, I think, on what it takes to be a really good one. Yeah.
Well, I guess you kind of came around to the point I was hitting, running up against. Oh, Bourdain, Chang, Zauner, say, throw Stanley Tucci in there, throw Rick Bragg in there, book we like, you know. They are, the food is the hook, but it's about relationships and family and character. Like, Chang is the main character of Eat a Peach, not the food. Michelle Zauner and her mom are the main characters. Bourdain is the main character of everything he does, whether it's quiet as it's kept or maybe loud as it's kept.
Yeah, I think where I want to see things go next and where I think they might be going is, like, just books about food becoming a bigger deal. And the most notable one that I've seen recently is there's the Netflix series High on the Hog, which is specifically about Southern Black food traditions and the evolution of those, where they came from. And that's based on a book that came out like almost 10 years ago, maybe more than that. I remember meeting the author of that at a SIBA conference, like back in my early blogging days. And so it's also taken that long for it to reach the hands of somebody who was like, this would be a good show and we should shine a light on what this book is about. So I think that's where I want to go with my food reading. And that's just where I'm just tending to read more books of that. Like, there's just more straight nonfiction kind of happening in my life these days.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I just want to learn about this thing. And the lens of that one person's particular experience is becoming less important for how I learn about those things.
And I'm sure it's true, because I've read plenty of books about it, memoirs, that running a restaurant is hard and weird. Mm-hmm. Got it. Message received. We got that. I got that one covered. Also, that food is pretty important to people's identities and families. It's like, I know what ice cream is. I like different flavors. I'll have ice cream from time to time, but hard for ice cream to blow my mind in a way that some of, you know, No Reservations or Blood, Bones, and Butter, or some of those, you know, that kind of had the expose quality, or like, I can't believe this is what people do. Maybe, you know, I was starting to think, okay, I would like, maybe there's one out there, like, who's been a waiter at, like, Chez Panisse for 50 years? Wouldn't you read that memoir? Like, you're not the chef. You're just, like, making the thing happen. I don't know. I don't think I've seen one of those. But maybe there's still things to be mined there. But, like, the two central pillars of food memoirs, which are, boy, it's weird to run a restaurant and be a chef, and cooking is hard, and there's the cast of characters, and look at these rebel pirates. And then also the, I really like my mom's biscuits, you know, but insert food item from whatever region or cuisine all kind of interesting, but I know what that is at this point.
Yeah, I think we need, it's time for some new flavor of it.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know. I don't know if that was something, is it something or nothing? I guess it was. Our food memoirs past their peak. They haven't fallen to zero, but past the peak.
You were correct that your surprise spandex wrestling moment occupied our whole time today.
That's it, Rebecca. Whatever these other things we'll have to hit for next time, shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. If you disagree or have other spins on the something or nothings, love to hear it. Also, your top three book properties that are that you would bet on, if you had to bet on, to be turned into good adaptations or popular adaptations. Rebecca's running late. She's very polite me telling me, because I wasn't paying you the time. And we'll talk to you all later.
Have a good one.